This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, I'm Chua Eun-sik. You're listening to Human Rights Defenders, an eight-part series with the Human Rights Commission of Malaysia, better known as Suhakam. Each week, I speak to one of the eight appointed commissioners about the work they do, ask them why they are passionate about human rights, and what they hope to achieve during their term. This week, I speak to Dr. Nick Salida. Dr. Nick is also a senior lecturer at the Faculty of Sharia and Law, University Science Islam Malaysia. She specializes in Islamic laws on human rights and women, as well as Islamic family law. She was appointed as Commissioner of Suhakam in June 2016 to a three-year term. Dr. Nick Salida, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for inviting me.
You teach the law, and you write about the law and how it relates to human rights. Why did you want to be a commissioner?
Well, I have four important agenda to be a commissioner of Suhakam. The first one is in terms of educational purposes, in which I believe that dissemination and contribution of knowledge to our societies for the understanding of human rights and Islam is very important. Because when I involved with a community program, I noticed that there are misunderstandings between Muslim community about human rights. Some of them totally reject human rights, and they claim that human rights is liberal, human rights is un-Islamic, there is no such thing as human rights in Islam, so on and so forth. And this surprised me, and I do believe that it is not because they reject human rights, but it's because they don't have any idea about what is rights, what is human rights, how to enjoy human rights, and how to defend human rights. Well, this is, in Islam, is very important. I mean, human rights and Islam is harmonious. And secondly is for involvement. Academic field and academic world is totally different with real ground world. So for me, to involve with community and to help minority groups advocating for their rights, it is important for me to be with them, to be in the center, not to be marginalized. I mean, you have to speak out. So in that sense, without involvement with this group and community, I don't believe that by staying in my office, sitting on the chair in front of the PC, and then write books, write articles, it will satisfy enough for me to contribute myself in this field. So second thing for me is involvement. And the third one is research. In university, lecturers do research, okay? But anyway, in Suhakam as well, officers do research. So combining the idea and the perspective of doing research in academic industry, and also Suhakam industry, plus also sometimes we do cooperate with NGO. These dimensions help, if I could say, government, human rights advocates, NGOs, and also Suhakam itself to formulate a model and framework on how to develop the best human rights practice in Malaysia. So we can't stay apart from research. And research must not only be done by those who are in academic industry, but also together with those involved directly with the problem. So the third one is research. And last but not least is practical. Before joining Suhakam, I did my PhD, something related to women's rights and United Nations Convention. Everything I did was only go to the library, reading, arguing, writing, submitting. So in that sense, I don't feel like I did enough. So I keep thinking what else I'm lacking of. So I noticed that it is something about practical. So in Suhakam, I go to lockup. I went to prison. I went to meet those who have problem in terms of human rights issues. And that things really helped me in understanding what is actually happening in this country. So, I mean, these four purposes, I think it's too big. This is, anyway, the mission to be a commissioner.
Okay, I want to pick on the first point then, that you brought up about this relationship between Islam and human rights.
Yeah.
You said it should be harmonious, but there is this seeming tension. And I think a lot of the language at the international level would be that human rights have to be appropriated for the local context of each country. So for the Malaysian context, what would that mean?
The international standard of human rights principle underpinned by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 1948 is very general in its nature. Why it is general? Because for state parties of the United Nations to employ the principle in their particular states and to their particular people, there are slightly differences in terms of how you interpret the rights itself. And for human rights to be implemented realistically in any countries, not only in Malaysia, it must be very friendly with the local context, okay? And how the local context define law, how local context define culture, belief, custom, so on and so forth is very important to make human rights principle able to be adopted and to be employed by the people. So we have to understand also, even though UDHR is very general and local context sometimes is so specific, but it must not go against the principle of human rights stated in the UDHR. And the principle is something which is important for us to adopt, not the word, not the term, not every single wording as stated in the provisions. If we want to adopt the wording, but still the definition of the word and term is, you know, depend on the country or the state parties of the United Nations who employ and define it. So what is important is that make sure the principle of human rights in the UDHR is applied. For example, we do have in the preamble of UDHR, we have what we call as dignity and equal. So the principle of dignity and equal underpinned by freedom, by justice, must be adopted. If you say that, well, we are quite different because we want to make it in our local context, but every single law that you adopt is all discriminating people, of course you will not say that this is a human rights law based on the international standard because you don't apply the principle behind it. So the principle is very important.
I want to go through a few recent headlines in the country, and I think you are the most qualified person to talk about this because each of these instances, religion and the law, there is an overlap. Let's begin with the move by the Kelantan state government to sanction public caning. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think Suhakam has released a statement saying that this is against the principles laid out in the United Nations Convention Against Torture, a convention which Malaysia is not a signatory to. Your thoughts on that?
We do have 158 countries in the world accepted UN Convention Against Torture. And as of now, 32 nations have yet to ratify, including Malaysia and our neighbor countries, Myanmar and Singapore. The reason being why government of Malaysia reserve ratification is because, according to the government, the UNCAT is not consistent with our federal constitution and not consistent with Sharia as practiced in Malaysia itself, and also because maybe because of the corporal punishment that we apply in this country, for instance, caning. So if we still have caning as part of our types of punishment, it means that we can't apply UNCAT. Unless you abolish caning, then you can invite UNCAT to come to our country. So this belief for me, reflecting public caning introduced by
the Kelantan state government.
Basically, we have to understand that Suhakam does not agree on caning under the principle of human rights. So as in Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia, also among countries that had been abolished caning. I mean, Well, people might argue that, you know, Islam allow caning, but we sometimes have to readopt the latest thinking on the method and the way how execution is conducted. So in that sense, maybe the principle of caning is there as a punishment to deter or to teach or to educate. But then again, how you punish people, sometimes you invite torture. So when I say the first thing is Suhakam does not accept caning, I have the second choice. And the second choice is that if even though caning is allowed, whether it can be public. So in that sense, bear in our mind that caning, even though it is executed in prison and witnessed by more than two people, that is public already. So the principle that Islam allows public caning, I believe it is based on Quranic verse. It's, if I'm not mistaken, it is in Surah An-Nur verse number 2, that it must be witnessed by those who believe. So the reason being why it must be made in public, number one, is because for Muslim to be educated that, you know, don't do this or otherwise you have to face this. So this is kind of warning. Number two is that when you have witness, for sure, not all people in this whole wide world will come and witness it. So those who don't come, no problem, because those who witness it will share the story with those who didn't attend. So that is why in Islam, public caning is allowed because the purpose is for education. And number three is for those who witness it, for them to pray for the offender to be forgiven by Allah. So I basically agree with these three reasons why public caning should be allowed. But from human rights lens, I have to stress out that please consider the dignity. Please consider the element of torture when you punish the offender in public, because the punishment is whipping or caning, not to be shamed in public.
In your dialogue with the government, is caning here to stay for the foreseeable future, or is it something that we are trying to move away from?
Because we are advocating for the government to ratify United Nations Conventions against torture. So if government signed the convention, it means that this corporal punishment will be abolished. So based on our meetings with Home Ministry, Foreign Ministry, and also AG Chambers, we do believe that something is now being done in progress by the government, and the officers always mention that they are supporting this agenda. And what constrain them to ratify it for now is to ensure that, you know, the other ministries and agencies improve themselves and also monitor the compliance of its standard operative procedure as well. It is not only signature, because signing does not solve all the problems, okay? But all agencies, ministries, they have also ensured that they themselves are ready and will monitor how the SOP is to be implemented.
I'm speaking today to Suhakam Commissioner Dr. Nick Salida. We'll talk more about unilateral conversion and gender discrimination after this short break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Human Rights Defenders, a weekly conversation with commissioners from Suhakam. My guest today is Dr. Nick Salida, who is also Senior Lecturer of the Faculty of Sharia and Law at University Sains Islam Malaysia. I want to move on now to the case of unilateral conversion.
All right.
Recently, the government decided to withdraw the Law Reform Marriage and Divorce Act. Clause 88A was the issue in contention here. What it says is that the religion of the child should remain the same mm-hmm. of the parents before marriage or before their conversion until the child is 18 years of age. Mm-hmm. And it concerns Indira Gandhi, who has not seen her daughter since she was...
7 years, maybe the last one.
7 years, yeah. She's 8 years 8 years old this year, but she hasn't seen her since she was one because they were both Hindu, but the husband converted later and unilaterally converted all three of their children to Islam. Mm-hmm. Would you know why the government decided to U-turn on this issue?
If you ask me why, well, I'm not the best person to answer. But from the research that I've done, what I understand was that Clause 88 is not consistent with federal constitution and also not consistent with Sharia principle, and also for maintaining the peace and harmony of this multiracial and also multi-religious citizen in this country. That's all. However, from human rights lens again, in which I do believe that Islam and human rights is harmonious, religion only is not guarantee that the welfare of the of the particular children is protected. We just been shocked with the news that a father raped his own daughter more than 600 times. And the daughter is also the victim of broken marriage, family as well. And the custodianship is given to the father. Father looking after small, little, beautiful girl without mother. And this is what is, you know, the end result that we all know. So in that sense, religion without practicing it will not protect the child's interests and welfare. So, I mean, this is a challenge to us. How can we do, what can we do to ensure that, yes, you want to say that religion can protect so that ask them to be in this religion, but how to ensure that these children or this child or this daughter will also be protected in this particular religion. So there is a challenge. And in Indira Gandhi case, what I understand is that the appeal court reject the idea of High Court, which High Court cancelled the conversion of three children of Indira Gandhi in their status as Muslim. So when another party appealed to the appeal court, and then appeal court decided that this is a Sharia Islamic law matter, and Sharia court sitting by Datuk Dr. Badaria, Hakim Balia, and also Hakim Datuk Dr. Hamid Sultan Abu Bakar decided that when it is a Sharia law, Sharia matters, Sharia law issues, then it's supposed to be decided by Sharia court. This is where Indira Gandhi feels like I have to appeal because I am a mother. I carry my children for 9 months and I deliver them. I look after them and then end up, they are away from me. So for...
Can she appear at the Sharia court?
She cannot because she is not a Muslim. So there is a conflict in terms of, you know, jurisdiction as well over here, because she can bring the case to civil court for civil court to decide on the custody matter, and the husband also can bring the same case to Sharia court because this is an Islamic law personal matter. So there is a conflict in which I do think that we up to now still have no idea on how to settle this tensions and conflict of jurisdiction between Sharia and civil court. So the best that we can propose is that before any parties convert to Islam, please ensure that you, husband and wife, get divorced first. When you convert without settling the divorce application, divorce issue, that becomes a problem because you go to another court and this person go to another court. But if you get divorced first before you convert, then you can settle in one court only.
What about the child's religion? Is it not common sense to get both parents to consent whether a child's religion should be changed before the age of 18?
Well, the question really relates on how in our country that practicing religion is not that free. Well, I want to say that if you are Muslim or you are non-Muslim, wherever you go, whoever you stay with, you can practice. I mean, if the child is Muslim, if you stay with the father or you stay with the mother, you can practice your religion, no problem at all. But now our concern is that you will practice your religion if you stay with Muslim, and you will practice your Christianity if you stay with Christian, in which for me, it's supposed not to be an issue at all, because in our country, it's up to you how you want to practice your religion, I mean, which is still under the ambit of the principle of the religion. So, well, we have to say that this is children. Of course, they have to be guided by an adult, okay? So, as a mother, if the same happened to any mother, all mothers will feel that it is not fair at all. So, it's quite a challenge to understand. At the same time, as a Muslim, I don't want to say that Sharia is promoting injustice for Muslim and for non-Muslim, because Sharia underpinned by the justice and dignity principle and equal rights. So we need special attention and special debate. We need specific thoughts and understanding on this issue, because I can see the conflict between what Islam say and the conflict between the best interests of child, and also not to discriminate any mother, not to discriminate any father in this issue. Because not only if the father convert, okay, the same happened when a mother convert and the father did not convert. So the child will go with the one who convert. For me, these issues is unsolved. I don't want to say yes or no. I don't want to say what is now that we have is fair enough. Okay, I do think there are still a wide door opened and inviting thoughts and also a debate how to ensure that principle of Islam and also human rights principle is not contradicted in this issue.
In July, when Shell had to remove life-size cardboard cutouts of a female employee from all its petrol stations because pictures of men groping the cutouts were going viral on social media. What did you make of that episode? Do you think this is a human rights issue?
Yeah, it is a common sense. Well, do you think the poster itself is wrong? Or the act of that male or masculine attitude is wrong? Which one? For me, it is of no wrong that the poster, I mean, for a kind of promotion or you want to say anything, to be there if you, men or women, respect it. Okay, but now the issue is, why you want to show this masculine attitude of controlling disrespect? And then the one which is considered wrong is the poster itself, not that attitude. So this is how sometimes law cannot be an instrument of change to improve our life. But what is important is that our attitude, our culture, our lifestyle, our masculine attitude, our male bias attitude, in which making everything related to women will be women's wrong. So, respect it's not there.
So we recently beefed up our Domestic Violence Act, and we also have the thought of sexual harassment. What are your views on this movement to criminalize stalking and online harassment? Because I think that is one way that law can do something about this behavior towards women in general.
Because we do not have sexual harassment law in our country, and then what we have now is only Section 509 of the Penal Code, which criminalizes the offense of insulting the modesty of women, in which for me it is very wide. And because of that, government start to formulate sexual harassment code. And because it is only a code, it does not have any, has any force of law. And in 2010, for instance, 1 year after the implementation of the code, out of 450,000 companies, registered companies that we have in this country, only 400 companies adopted the code out of 450,000. So there is no interest of the company, of the employer, to adopt the code, because for them, sexual harassment issue in the workplace is not an important matter. It's not an important matter. So, but then for women, we still have like, oh, well, our simple problem is not get settled. I mean, for a few years already. So, however, in 2012, in Employment Act 1955, the definition of sexual harassment is amended. Well, it is still an issue, because what we need is the holistic perspective of sexual harassment, its SOP of report to be made, and what is the protection for the victim, for instance, and then if this happen, where we want to go, where we have to go, is there any protection provided by the government if we make a report, for instance, and then what is about the witness? So all this thing is not yet there in our law. So that's why, even though we do have sexual harassment problem in workplace everywhere, if I can say that, there is still a victim refuse to report because they know that it is of nowhere.
What do you hope to achieve during this term?
Remember the four missions? Mm-hmm. I want to achieve that four missions. So, for instance, in terms of education, on my first 12 months of appointment, I managed to have more than 50 talks and engagement with religious community and religious groups to talk about human rights and Islam alone. Okay, so including in the TV or in a mosque, and also in terms of maybe seminar or public forum and public lecture. So at least, even though not all, but the development of number for those who understand Islam is very much correlated with human rights, and human rights is Islam is, you know, satisfy me enough for the first year of the appointment.
What feedback do you get when you speak to these religious communities?
Well, last few days, I was with a group of religious teachers in Wilayah Persekutuan alone, those who teach in Sekolah Rendah Agama and also Kafa. It surprised me when they ask lots of questions related to human rights. I mean, what surprised me is they know human rights, they understand human rights, they know how to defend human rights, but they don't know that is human rights. Okay, so by, I mean, engaging with them and allowing them asking question, all of the question mostly related to educational issues, related to current issues as well, as you mentioned just now, public caning, unilateral conversion, they have direct answer from the commissioner. And also, it answers also question and issues and tensions that they have been thinking for years about discrimination in school, for instance, among students. So after 16 years of the establishment of Suhakam itself, until now, we can't really say whether Malaysian citizens understand human rights or not. Okay? They sometimes think like, I have my rights and other people also have rights. So if my rights is conflict with the whole majority of people in this country, my rights supposed also to be prevailed because I have rights. So when we have conflict between public rights and individual rights, we have to know that under the human rights knowledge and perspective, what will prevail is public rights, not your rights as individual. So this is things that normally people don't know. Yeah, so that is why I think come forward. If you think something which is not right at your place, come to Suhakam and make a report. Because one of our function is to receive complaint and also to investigate and also try to solve the problem. If we have to advise government to change the law, then we do so. We also involve in advising the government on all issues related to human rights.
Dr. Nick Salida, thank you very much for speaking
to
me.
Welcome.
You've been listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.